From South Carolina Public Radio, this is On the Keys. I'm your host, David Kaiser. I'm very happy to bring you a special program this evening. I finally visited the Carolina Music Museum, which we heard in its early genesis some years ago on this show. Now, it's not that I haven't visited before, but this time I brought my microphones with me. The museum is housed in the Heritage Green Art Space in downtown Greenville, adjacent the History Museum and the Greenville County's Mothership Library. Its building was the former Coca-Cola bottling plant. Of this airing, the exhibit Facing South, Keyboard Instruments and Makers that were exported to Charleston in the early 18th century and on, will be dismantled to make way for a new exhibit that is of such vast extent to have the museum changing its name. This is a vastly important cultural institution for South Carolina, and I hope that you will visit in person. Lisa Kaiser, a board member of the museum and pianist, and I visited and played selections spanning the age range of the early pianos and harpsichord. The idea is to trace the development of the piano from early to nearly modern, and to let you hear what it may have sounded like to members of the St. Cecilia Society of Charleston, via composers known and unknown to us. And we'll remember that black slaves were mentioned in the same advertisements in the newspapers as these imported pianos, and it is not clear yet the amount of access they would have had to these instruments, though they would have certainly heard this music. Special thanks to Tom Strange, the museum's founder, for guiding us through these instruments. Though the actions are lighter, playing these keyboard instruments is hard, and no wonder pianists can spend years in study of historic performance practice on historic keyboard instruments or imitations. In comparison, a modern uniform Steinway drives like a seamless modern sports car, compared to an old English roadster of eminent mechanical feel, clicks and thumps and all. Hopefully in this show, you'll be able to hear the progression of the piano sound as the colonists in early America heard it. Cristofori invented the piano in Italy in the very early 1700s. It might have been 1700. But in England, where Charleston got most of its instruments, the harpsichord was still the king and would stay that way until the early 1800s. That meant all of the keyboard music of Haydn up until the last three piano sonatas were written for the harpsichord in mind. Interestingly, it was a visit to London that inspired Haydn to take up writing specifically for the new piano that had, of all things, a damper pedal, thus the famous long pedals of the last C major sonata. But before that, the harpsichord was the instrument of choice and the affordable option. It was a lot of fun wrangling with this instrument at the museum, and you'll hear Haydn on it shortly. First, imagine, if you will, courtesy of Patrick Hawkins' essay, after a fine book called Votaries of Apollo by Nicholas Butler, it's fall, 1787 in Charleston. The St. Cecilia Society's new season is in full swing. It's been more than 100 years since the first house concert, and the Revolutionary War only put a smallish damper on things. The State Gazette of South Carolina announces a concert date to be held at the City Tavern. And this particular concert is special, because it is said to be the only existing record of a program from that time that included sonatas by Haydn and played by Alexander Juhan, J-U-H-A-N. Mr. Hawkins surmises that the E minor sonata might have been played. The program mentions expressly the piano forte, which was probably enough to get people in the door to hear this expressive and expensive new instrument. The piano forte we'll hear soon enough, but Haydn had the harpsichord in mind, and that's how you'll hear it. Tom Strange gives us further background about this instrument.
The one that we're going to hear here is the Jacob Kirkman double manual harpsichord. This one is a pretty special instrument because it has the elaborate marquetry inlay decoration. Very, very few of these ever got this kind of treatment, and it's sort of significant that they were built for wealthy homeowners in England and in America. Anybody that could afford to really, really have the very finest would buy one of these. The one from 1761 was the wedding present from King Charles to his new bride, Charlotte. And that one is in the Siegel Musical Instrument Collection, which will be coming to Greenville here in the spring. So we'll actually have two of these wonderful instruments, and that'll be a special treat. When you look at the harpsichord and you see the two manuals, the first question people ask is, why does it need two manuals? Why can't you just get the music out of one? And the part of the reason is that since the harpsichord cannot play loud and soft, then we are able to change the way the sound appears to the ear by perhaps plucking the string a little closer to where it leaves the case. And so we get all the harmonics when we do that, and that's called nasard or nasal stop. Another way of doing it is we can pluck one string or two strings at the same pitch, and they've chosen the 8-foot strings, the ones that are the common frequency that you would hear on any instrument that you sat down to and played. And so that can give you either a kind of thin solo sound or the much more resonant two-string sound. And then the last thing that we could hear is the 4-foot stop, which is an octave higher than the 8-foot. So every time I hit a note, I'm actually hitting a note an octave higher. And then that gives it a kind of a full organ-like sound. So if I step through these, you can hear it very quickly on the upper keyboard. We can play that nasally sort of stop. And then if I push in a jack that allows me to play a little deeper into the string, I can keep all of those harmonics, but get more of the fundamental sound. And if I take that stop off, and you play only the single 8-foot, now it's just kind of sweet. So there's three different sounds just from the upper keyboard. On the lower keyboard, as I said, I can play one of the 8-foot strings or two together. And then with the 4-foot stop in place, and it gives a very organ-like sound. So you have all of these possible sonic variations that you can call on while playing the pieces.
So let's return to this recital by Mr. Juhan and listen to how his listeners may have. Thank you. That was Haydn's Sonata in E Minor, the first movement, from about 1770, played on a Kirkman harpsichord, currently on display at the Carolina Music Museum in downtown Greenville. I had fun playing that piece on the harpsichord, whereas I was extremely used to hearing it and playing it on the piano. This is South Carolina Public Radio, and the show is On the Keys. I'm David Kaiser. In 1758, the year of this harpsichord, what was happening with the early piano?
So the piano is very much in development, and we find it in Italy, we find it in Spain, find it in Germany. The problem for the piano is still the same one at this time, which is it's very expensive. It costs about 2.5 times more than a harpsichord to build a piano because there's more inside of it, a beefier frame, and a much, much more complex action. There's no music written for the piano yet. And everyone that has trained as a keyboardist is either an organist or a harpsichordist. So, and everybody that's a musician is looking at it and saying, it's too expensive, I couldn't afford it, there's no music written for it, and I'm not trained to play that anyway, thank you, and then they would move along. And it wasn't until, in my opinion, until the square piano comes along in 1766 and is rapidly adopted because it's cheap. It doesn't matter that there's no music written for it because we're really just having fun with it. And it doesn't matter that you weren't trained to play it because we're just having fun with it. And when enough pianos were around, suddenly the music publishers were saying, let's write some music and say for harpsichord or pianoforte. And if they have either one, they'll buy our music. Ultimately, the piano, with its ability to play soft and loud and to express within a single note something different from its neighbors, begins to win out. And by the 1795, the harpsichord is in steep decline. By 1800, it's essentially extinct, and the piano takes over.
Let's listen now to that square piano that Tom Strange tells us is responsible for getting the public to appreciate the actual piano sound. In early America, much of the music they heard would have been categorized now and perhaps dismissed as light classical. And the only name I recognize from that time is Haydn. He seemed to be quite popular in the colonies. It would take some time for Beethoven to make an appearance in Charleston, not until the early 19th century. Folks gathered around the piano for entertainment. What they liked to play may have been the music of Stephen Foster, and a Mozart and Beethoven contemporary, Leopold Kozeluh, K-O-Z-E-L-U-H, or Daniel Steibelt, a man of many virtuoso concertos.
So this is the Robert Nunzen Clark square piano, made in 1834, shipped through Charleston. A company called Deming and Bulkley in Charleston were the vendors, and it was sold into Fairfield County, South Carolina, when it was new. Came to a young lady whose name was Eliza Lyles. She was 18, and the piano was bought for her 18th birthday present and also for her wedding present. She was marrying Thomas Lyles, and she had been to the Salem School for Girls in North Carolina, as most planners would send their daughters to Salem School because it was kind of the premier school to go to, where she learned, among other things, how to play the piano. And apparently, it was a real joy for her. So when she came home, then this was one of the first things that she got. And she kept it very well. The family kept the piano very well through its life. At the end of the Civil War, when Sherman's troops were coming through Fairfield County, they went to the various plantations, and they were, you know, making mischief and taking things. And one of the things that they would do is, if you had something that was nice but useless to live, then like a piano, they would take it out in the front yard and chop it up just to kind of dispirit people. They were going to do that with this piano, and Eliza begged them to play it and sing for them one last time. And when she got finished, apparently there was no more interest in taking the piano out into the yard and chopping it up. And so the piano survived the war. And Eliza survived the war. She lived to a great old age. And then her youngest daughter, Carrie, had the piano. Carrie's daughter then took it to Greenville, and that's where I found it at an auction. And then all of this history came out. So a neat piano with a neat South Carolina connection. And I'm sure that Eliza, like so many of the ladies of the time, had her own little a bunch of music that she liked to play and may well have had it bound into a book, which was quite popular to do at the time. And those books are wonderful because not only have they organized the music so that we can look at it, but they put it into an order that the person that owned it would have found important to them. So we can get an idea of what did they like to play, what groupings of music did they enjoy. It's a nice little revelation into the mind of the antebellum South.
Here is Kojula's Pastoral. In it you can hear the mute pedal of this nun's piano. Kojula's Pastoral, on the 1834 Robert Nunn's square piano that lived its whole life in South Carolina. Here's another piece that may have been put in the family's bounded music book, and it's a rondo by Daniel Steibelt. Daniel Steibelt was an enterprising enough, or his editor was, to take the famous tune from his piano concerto and put it in a more digestible manner. Thus, the Storm Rondo was born. Here, the lower register trills signify the storm, and this is definitely playable by your average pianist. ¶¶ let me play the same passage, but from the original concerto. Here the composer writes that if your piano has 6 octaves in range, you had better play this optional passage, which is more difficult. The piano repertoire grew quite literally in range as recent piano technology could allow. Stephen Foster was also extremely popular, and we might imagine Eliza playing and singing the hymn Tears Bring Thoughts of Heaven, and perhaps following it with lighter fare like the Village Bells Polka. Music by Stephen Foster, played on the 1834 Robert Nunn's square piano, that spent its whole life in South Carolina, narrowly escaping destruction by General Sherman's troops in 1865. You are listening to On the Keys. I'm your host, David Kaiser, and this is South Carolina Public Radio. On this show, we are exploring the development of the piano at the Carolina Music Museum. There are few places in the world that you can hear what we will play next for you. This is Mozart's quirky Beethoven fugue in C minor. It's for the odd combination of two forte pianos, pianofortes. This is dissonant, powerful music that works here because we have two pianos by John Broadwood made mumps from each other, as Tom Strange explains. This is a rare matched pair.
We're fortunate that Steve Bickel, who is the owner of the 1792, is loaning this to the museum to allow us to present what you're going to hear in just a little bit, which is, in this case, with two pianos that are very, very closely matched. These pianos look a lot like the harpsichord we were just playing, but on the inside, they're very much different. The strings are a little heavier, so that when the struck string is excited, then it'll have enough resonance to really sound. There's nothing quite so energetic as plucking a string. But if you're hammering it, then you need a little bit heavier string to make it work. And then both of these pianos are going to be tuned to the same pitch. In this case, we're using A420, which would have been just about what it would have been in London at this time.
Lisa and I will play the Mozart. You have just heard the fugue in C minor for two pianos by W.A. Mozart. Lisa Kaiser at one piano, and I was at the other one, 1791 and 1792 John Broadwood grand pianos. Now Lisa Kaiser plays the first movement of Mozart's Sonata in D major, K311, on the John Broadwood piano of 1791. That was Lisa Kaiser playing the first movement of Mozart's Sonata in D major, K311. Let's just listen to the opening of the sonata again with the Broadwood that has the lovely veneer on it. This is, I believe, is the 92. Which sound do you prefer? But these pianos sound remarkably closer to the harpsichord in sound than to the modern grand piano. When did the development really switch over, if you agree with that opinion. I mean, we will look at an Erard piano that, for me, sounds like it's on the verge. But what technically is making that difference in sound?
So one of the things that began to happen was this seeking for additional sonority and singing power. And you can see that in not only the advertisements for the various instruments as people would bring out new things, but also, you know, the demands from the musicians for, you know, more and more of this sort of sound. And in order to get more sonority out of a piano, some physical things have to change. The size of the diameter of the string has to grow so that there's more metal there singing. The soundboard has to get larger so that there's more soundboard to resonate. The hammers have to get heavier so that they can actually energize and activate the strings. And as the hammers get heavier, the whole mechanism has to be rethought such that it stays responsive to the touch, but allows a much heavier hammer to take place. So during the 19th century, the musicians and the public were demanding more and more from pianos, and the builders, working within the tradition of, you know, wanting to not get too far away so that, you know, you're not getting really strange, but getting far enough away that you're besting your competition, you know, became the real focus. When the string diameter goes up, the tension on the piano goes exponentially up. And so what are you going to do to support those strings? And in 1825, Alpheus Babcock brings out the full cast iron frame for a square piano. It was as welcome at the time as somebody clapping a piece of iron on a violin. It's sort of like, what are you doing? Iron must hurt the sound of the instrument. Well, of course, it really doesn't. But it's a little bit strange, and people who were used to seeing pianos without any iron in them at all were naturally suspicious of this. It took about 20 years for that concept to fully take root, and Jonas Chickering picked it up from Babcock and brings it forward. And by 1860, American pianos have full iron frames, and they take them to Europe, and they storm all the competitions. The Americans were winning everything, hands down. Their pianos were so much bigger, so much louder, so much more robust. And the Europeans had to catch up or not. And the ones that didn't catch up ultimately failed to grow and thrive.
Is that what happened to Broadwood? What was there?
Broadwood was very conservative as a company, and so they were slow to adopt. Now, it's interesting that you know, they did ultimately adopt the technologies that were necessary. And I like to point out that though it's only in a small way, Broadwood still lives. So it is still possible to buy a new Broadwood upright piano in the UK.
So where does the Erard fit into that?
Well, the Erard is part of our transitional instrument. So this one is really nice. It's from 1863. We think of Erard as a French company, but as it turns out, during the French Revolution, Erard had to leave Paris, and he came to London, and he set up shop in London and was very successful there, like he had been in Paris. When the war was over and he could go back to Paris, he left the London shop running. And so he was one of the few makers that had a large shop both in London and in Paris. The London shop ultimately began to focus on building some of the more expensive, highly veneered instruments. And this is an example of a London Erard, but really embodying that mid-19th century aesthetic. So a piano that Liszt and Brahms would have been very familiar with. Hearing Brahms on one of these is something of a revelation, because while it has a much more modern sound, a little bit of iron has entered this piano. It doesn't have a full iron frame, but it has some iron tensioning bars, and it's all scaled more nearly like a modern piano, but it isn't quite modern. And so, you know, we're still getting a little bit of that, you know, the warmth and projection of the early piano that's a little bit swamped out when you get to a full Steinway D that has so much power and so much sonority that some of the nuances have been left behind.
Wasn't Erard responsible for having big technical improvements in the action.
It is, in fact, the Erhard action that ultimately carried the day. So all pianos today, built anywhere in the world, have an action that looks a lot like what the Erhard action looked like. There are little subtle changes, and they were all patented, and they were all touted, and the accelerated action of Steinway and et cetera. But it's essentially the idea of Erhard here in the first half of the 19th century.
This date of the piano, the Erhard, makes it particularly suitable for the music of Franz Liszt. Here, Lisa Kaiser, in one take, sat down and played the composer's Rigoletto paraphrase after opera music by Verdi. The Erhard action made much of the virtuosics in this possible. When I hear this piano, I think of how lucid the texture is, and how mellow and lovely the middle register. The bass never overpowers.
Thank you.
Lisa Kaiser played for us the Rigoletto paraphrase by Franz Liszt, after music of Verdi at the Carolina Music Museum, on the most modern piano that you'll hear on this program, an 1863 Erard Grand, that is part of a transitional exhibit of the museum, and a collection that will have this new cultural institution of the Carolinas change its name. Special thanks to Lisa Kaiser for volunteering to play for this program and to supply much of the music you heard. Both of us are, well, expertises on the modern Steinway piano, so this was an educational learning for us to play and share these instruments with you, and we enjoyed it. Special thanks to her, and special thanks to Tom Strange and the staff of the Carolina Music Museum for making this show possible. And that's our show. You've been listening to On the Keys here on South Carolina Public Radio. I'm your host, David Kaiser. You can find playlists of this show at our website, scpublicradio.org. The show's email address is keys@scpublicradio.org. This program is supported by your kind contributions to this station. Have a musical week.